ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. President Biden called the decision to send cluster munitions to Ukraine a difficult one, but some NATO allies are opposed to the decision. That includes the defense minister of Spain. And ABC's Mary Alice Park says this decision comes just before next week's NATO summit.
Of course, we expect that NATO will look at other ways to support Ukraine, but also debate its own membership. Just this last year, NATO grew. Finland was formally introduced as a new alliance partner in April, meaning that NATO has a new border with Russia.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen continuing her meetings in Beijing, telling her Chinese counterpart that the U.S. would protect its interests. 4 days in the last week have broken records for the hottest global temperatures ever recorded. And police in Pennsylvania looking for a man who escaped from a Warren County jail. Michael Burham, considered very dangerous. He's being held on arson and burglary charges, also suspected in a homicide investigation. This is ABC News. Federal judge sentenced a Texas man to 90 life sentences for the 2019 massacre at an El Paso Walmart. Patrick Crucey has told police he was targeting Hispanic people. He pleaded guilty to federal hate crime and weapons charges. He could still face the death penalty in a state murder trial. A UPS strike now appears imminent, according to the head of the union that represents 340,000 UPS workers.
Negotiations between union workers and UPS breaking down earlier this week. Today, union officials said was the final deadline for the company to improve its offer. Teamsters General President Sean O'Brien telling GMA3.
UPS just has to pick up the phone, tell us they're going to agree to what our bottom line is, and they know what our bottom line is. We've been very transparent in these negotiations, and they know what needs to happen.
O'Brien described part-time UPS workers' wages as poverty pay and says after the stress of working through the pandemic, they deserve to be rewarded for their commitment. Dave Packer, ABC News.
Brian Clark, ABC News.
This summer, 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW has a new starting lineup.
Woo-hoo!
Starting at 6 a.m., The Mayor and Mino. Then at 8, The Earl Ingram Show. 10 to 12, As Goes Wisconsin. At noon, Civic Media Network News. At 12:15, Town Call. 1 to 3, The Todd Alba Show. 3 to 4, Matt Flynn Direct. 4 to 6, The Devil's Advocates with Diamond Crude. And 6 to 7, The Maggie Dawn Show. On 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba,
please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. A new vaccine aims to lower the severity of a respiratory infection known as RSV this winter, Mark Moran reports.
For most people, RSV is a mild respiratory infection, but for at-risk babies and seniors, it can be much more dangerous. RSV is a leading cause of hospitalization for infants in the U.S. It is estimated to cause around 10,000 deaths annually in Americans aged 65 and older. Flu and COVID now have safe and effective vaccines, but until now, RSV did not. Dr. Patricia Winokur at the University of Iowa led a vaccine trial and found it helpful at both ends of the age spectrum, but also for pregnant women and their babies.
And what they found is they could prevent disease in the babies for 90% of the time for 3 months. And then if you followed them for 6 months, they were about 80% protected.
RSV causes severe infections in young children. Most of the time, those infections aren't serious, but children born prematurely, with a low birth weight, or who have underlying health issues, run an increased risk of developing severe disease. This clinical trial was conducted among 37,000 adults aged 60 and older nationwide. Winokur says many of those who participated in the clinical trial had a few reasons for doing so.
They thought this was a really important way that they could protect themselves because they might be getting RSV from their grandkids, but also protect their grandkids.
Regulators will now study the best way to make the RSV vaccine available nationwide. I'm Mark Moran.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
This summer, 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW has a new starting lineup.
Starting at 6 a.m., The Mayor and Mino.
Then at 8, The Earl Ingram Show.
10 to 12,
As Goes Wisconsin.
At noon, Civic Media Network News.
At 12:15, Town Call.
1 to 3, The Todd Alba Show.
3 to 4, Matt Flynn Direct.
4 to 6, The Devil's Advocates with Dom and Crude.
And 6 to 7, The Maggie Dawn Show.
On 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW.
It's never personal, only politics. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show with Dom and Crute.
Weekdays from 4 until 6
on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning and welcome to this edition of Morning Cannolis. It is Saturday, July 8th, here in the state of Wisconsin, in the city of Waukesha. We're coming to you from the studios of WAUK in downtown Waukesha. But yes, as always, we're broadcasting throughout the listening areas, the regions of Civic Media in the state of Wisconsin. Welcome to all of our listeners, including all of our callers who may call in this hour and next hour. We're always taking your calls at 844-967-2789. That number once again, 844-967-2789. Always professionally, personably, engagingly handled by my wonderful producer, Anya, who's with me in the studio this morning. We're looking to hear from you, your questions, your comments, your observations about these major stories of our days. This happens to be, this Saturday, July 8th, the third in our three broadcast arc of shows focusing on the United States Supreme Court, a big period of time in our nation's history, as it almost always is now in June of every year, when our high court issues some of the most significant decisions that define who we are, certainly describe the ways in which our laws are to be administered, and also describe for us what our Constitution and those laws mean. And no exception this year, we have spent the last two shows talking about at least eight different cases that fall, as I'm going to talk about in just a few minutes, in two broad categories. Those series of cases from a couple of weeks ago in which the Supreme Court reaffirmed, upheld, supported longstanding tradition in America. We'll chat more about some of those in just a few moments. And then the week before last, four other cases in which the Supreme Court decided to dramatically change the standards, change the ways in which we understand what the law is under the Constitution, significant changes in the ways that America is understood, two broadly kinds of different things that happened in America from our United States Supreme Court in Washington, D.C. in recent weeks. We're going to chat about those, and we're going to talk in particular about one of the cases that was eclipsed by some of the larger, more headline-grabbing cases of recent times. I'm going to start with that in just a moment. As always, we ask, what do we know? What are the facts of these cases? What are the facts of the events of our times in which we live? What do we know about them with certainty? Hugely important. Why are those things, why are those facts important? Why are these cases important to us? Why are they relevant? Why are they material to the ways in which we live and interact with each other as members of a community? And what should we do about it? if there are things that can be done to support those decisions, to object to seek to rescind and return some of those decisions, those judgments, those rulings back to the way that they were before, or move them forward in some way. What should we do about our responses, our answers to what's going on in America? Those three principal questions. And again, this today, the third arc, not to indicate that we're going to be talking about nothing, not including the Supreme Court in the future. Supreme Court is going to be much on our agenda throughout this summer and beyond. But today, again, focusing in a major way upon those recent decisions, offering some three major observations, some perspectives that I have about these recent cases and the overall term, knowing that the Supreme Court this past term addressed 60 cases altogether. Many, many cases out there. You can take a look at them by going online, looking at the Supreme Court website, addressing not only the summaries of those cases, but the questions presented by them, figuring out who decided what, how these splits among the Supreme Court justices played out in those cases, but also an awful lot of commentary out there in America about, once again, the role of the Supreme Court in 21st century America. Certainly has always been the case, but the Roberts Court, like others in the past, defining who we are. I'm going to chat more about that. And again, offering to you this morning some observations, my observations about the big takeaways, the significance of these two sorts of sets of cases. We're going to talk about some civics issues related to standing, damages, and the circumstances under which the Supreme Court selects to choose various cases and disagreements to review and decide on. And then we're going to talk about the ways in which these cases are indeed, in a major way, not different from other cases in the past, but today truly reconstructing America, not just for now, but down the road as well. Those three big observations. We know as well the Supreme Court has a next term coming up. We're still in the 2022-2023 term. This term actually does not expire until September 30th of this year. And so during the course of the summer months, these weeks just ahead, we will probably talk about some of these decisions as they come forward. The Supreme Court still is on the job. Yes, they're still getting paid for doing their work. They do not simply leave on vacations and other places outside of Washington. But their work, the major work that they do in entertaining oral argument, reviewing briefs, and determining what these major cases should say to us, much of that is done. And the next term of the Supreme Court then opens on the first Monday in October. First Monday in October. And we know already that the Supreme Court has identified no fewer than 19 cases, 19 more cases that they're already going to be talking about in the next term, that term 2023-2024, probably by the time they're all done, somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 cases also on its docket for this coming term as well. Depending upon our time and our examination of what just happened in America from the Supreme Court today, I'm going to tell you about at least a few of those cases. I've done about four or five of them that while they may not strike you as earth-shaking in the way that some of the cases from this term have been, and even previous terms have been, are significant. And we'll give you a bit of a taste of those at the end of our broadcast this morning and into our next broadcast next Saturday. We are coming to you every single Saturday. This is our weekly review, our analysis and a discussion of those most important news events and stories in law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in America, which is ultimately, what the Supreme Court should be all about. Lots of controversy related to the Supreme Court, not only in the context of its recent decisions, some of which we'll revisit this morning, but also, of course, about its extracurricular behavior involving specifically Supreme Court Justice Sam Alito and Clarence Thomas. Issues related to whether or not there should, in fact, be a code of ethics either adopted by the Supreme Court itself, something that John Roberts and others have promised, or imposed upon it by the United States Congress. And the senator from Illinois, just to our south, Dick Durbin, who's the chair of the House of the Senate Judiciary Committee, has promised that sometime soon, when the Senate reconvenes, there will be some committee votes on whether or not to impose a strict and complete and thoughtful set of rules and regulations on the ethics of the Supreme Court. Unlikely that will get through Congress and the Senate, unlikely it'll be passed by the House, but nonetheless, a movement forward on that particular area. We're going to be talking about that surely in the broadcast to come as that congressional action goes forward, affecting the big building and the institution right across the parkway, right across the area there on Capitol Hill, in which the Supreme Court lives and works virtually every single business day and beyond. This morning, as I said, we're going to talk about one of those Supreme Court cases that we have chatted about a lot in the past, but did not have the opportunity to talk about in previous recent broadcasts because of the significance of many, many other cases in all these other areas that we've talked about previously. This one has to do with the independent state legislature theory. And again, we've chatted about this on this broadcast and on other broadcasts of civic media on a fairly routine basis. This past term, just a couple of weeks ago, on June 27th, the Supreme Court finally issued its decision on whether or not this thing called the independent state legislature theory has legs or not, adopting it or not, whether they're going to embrace what is, by everybody's estimation and codification, a fringe theory in American jurisprudence. An awful lot of people, myself included, regarded as crazy, as the kind of thing that James Madison, our founding fathers, never, ever contemplated when it comes to separation of powers and delegation of responsibilities among the branches of government. But nonetheless, our Supreme Court took this theory up and determined in the end, to the good of all of us, that it doesn't have any legs, that indeed this independent state legislature theory is not a credible theory and will not, in fact, guide the movement of government in the weeks, the months, and presumably the years ahead. Let's talk about where that comes from. The vote here is 6-3. Chief Justice John Roberts writing for the majority, and he says the Constitution does not exempt state legislatures from the ordinary constraints imposed by state law. Now, there's an awful lot to unpack there, right? Interestingly, once again, this fringe theory, the independent state legislature theory, was one that was rejected by 6 members of our Supreme Court and thus the majority. But nonetheless, 3 of them, including Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito and Neil Gorsuch, dissented from that view and presumably would have adopted some version of that. I would offer to you right at the top that in and of itself is a reason for concern that we've got 3 justices, 1/3 of our court, who are willing not only to entertain this, but entertain realistically the possibility that this particular theory should direct and guide the way in which we do elections, the way in which we do the judiciary in America. How did this come about? Well, the case is called Moore versus Harper. It concerned a voting map that was drawn by the North Carolina legislature after the 2020 census. We did that here in Wisconsin as well. You will all recall that after the census, all the states obliged to go back and determine how their lines for congressional districts and also state districts, assembly and senate in the state, but specifically here, congressional districts, how those lines are drawn based upon the determination by the census about population, where it lives, where we work, where we have our families, all those kinds of things. And like we did right here in Wisconsin, the North Carolina legislature likewise took the 2020 census results and they reviewed all of that. And by virtually everybody's estimation, engaged in a gerrymander. This is a political gerrymandering, not a racial gerrymander, and basically would have yielded a congressional delegation made up of 10 Republicans and 4 Democrats. And significantly, in the state of North Carolina, you may be surprised to hear, there is pretty much a split, probably a purple state out there, much like Wisconsin these days. And so an awful lot of people saw that the map that was drawn initially by the North Carolina legislature that accomplished this gerrymander accomplished also a partisan fit for the Republicans and not the Democrats. And so what happens is that the North Carolina Supreme Court comes back and says, nope, you've got to do a better job on all this, and sends it back to do that better job. Right after the break, I'm going to tell you what happens historically, how that decision ultimately gets reversed, and why the Supreme Court took up this case, inside of which is baked this independent state legislature theory. Stay with us for that conversation and more here on Morning Cannolis.
Attention, Wisconsin veterans. Hello, I'm Tony Evers, the governor of Wisconsin. If you are a veteran struggling to pay for rent, utilities, or other life-sustaining services, I want you to know that the Veterans Rental Assistance Program is here to help. You have already made a most noble sacrifice. You shouldn't have to continue doing so. We are here to support you. The Veterans Rental Assistance Program was created by and for people living in Wisconsin, with benefit approvals being issued to veterans in just days, not months. It's never easy to ask for assistance, but rest assured, we're here to help. You've always been there for us. We want you to know that we're here for you. Call 833-WISBRAP. That's 833-947-8727. Or visit VRAPWI.com. On behalf of the state of Wisconsin, thank you.
This summer, 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW has a new starting lineup.
Woo-hoo!
Starting at 6 AM, the Mayor and Mino.
Then at 8, the Earl Ingram Show.
10 to 12,
As Goes Wisconsin.
At noon, Civic Media Network News.
At 12:15, Town Call.
1 to 3, the Todd Alba Show.
3 to 4, Matt Flynn Direct.
4 to 6, the Devil's Advocates with Dom and Crude.
And 6 to 7, the Maggie Dawn Show.
On 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW.
Here's your updated forecast. Sunshine mixed with clouds at times this afternoon with a chance for scattered storms. High of 78, winds out of the north, 5 to 10 miles an hour. Lows dip down to about 57. Tonight, partly cloudy skies. High temperatures reach up to 82. Tomorrow, mainly clear skies and quiet. Chance for scattered storms Monday with highs in the upper 80s. Chance for scattered rain showers and highs in the upper 70s on Tuesday. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Ray Miller. Right now, it's 64.
This summer, 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW has a new starting lineup.
10 to 12,
As Goes Wisconsin.
At noon, Town Call.
On WGBW.
There I see.
We are back here in Morning Cannolis. It is Saturday, July 8th, and we're talking again this morning about the United States Supreme Court. This is the third in our series of discussions about the recent term of our high court, and spending some time this morning talking about a case that we have chatted about before, but we finally got a result from the Supreme Court rejecting something called the independent state legislature theory, in this case, Moore versus Harper. And right before the break, I was talking about the predicates of factual lead up to this particular decision. The 2020 census presented to the North Carolina legislature that looks at that census and draws lines with respect to the federal congressional and Senate seats, and basically determines that the seats will be delegated, if you will, almost between 10 Republicans and 4 Democrats, a partisan gerrymander, not a racial gerrymander here. The North Carolina Supreme Court gets a hold of this. There obviously is an appeal of that gerrymandered decision. The state court says two things. One, first of all, you haven't done this properly. You have engaged in a gerrymander. Go back and do this again. Draw lines in such a way that there is more balance, if you will, between these partisan divides that you've already created by virtue of the line drawing that you have done. But second, and the reason why this case is so very important beyond its significance for North Carolina voters and the legitimacy of their franchise there is just this. The state court there, the state Supreme Court, was presented with an argument that under this independent state legislature theory, the courts have no role in determining anything about elections. And how is that possible? How is that predicated upon the Constitution? Well, turns out that there's something called the Elections Clause. It's in the first article of our Constitution. It says this. It says the times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. Established by our founding fathers many, many, many years ago, to establish once again this notion that when it comes to electing federal officers to Congress, we'll leave it to the states to make up the rules and regulations about how that's done. If you think about it, of course, every single state then, through its legislature, establishes different rules for doing that. We're different from Illinois, different from California. We all have different processes about absentee voting, about early voting, about balloting, all kinds of things out there that are established by the legislature. And for most of our history, and to this day, thankfully, when there have been contests about the application of those rules and regulations established by the state legislature, where do you go? Where do you end up? You end up in front of the courts, right? You go to a court, you say, you know what? The time period for this election needs to be broadened. We need to ensure that people have the right to vote for these various practical means. We go to the courts, and the courts ultimately determine what will happen, applying, yes, the rules and regulations established by the legislature. Well, this independent state legislature theory would put that on its head and say, no, no, because our Constitution does not specifically say in that particular clause that there's a role for the courts to play, therefore there's none. And for that reason, it's only the legislatures that make determinations about the rules initially. But if there are contests, if there are disagreements, challenges to those rules in application, if there are challenges to who won elections, if there are challenges to electoral votes, all kinds of things related to elections in America, you go back to where? Not the courts. Nor do you go to the executive branch, the president or a governor. You go back to the legislature, and they are the exclusive, thus the independent state aspect of this theory. They're the exclusive branch of government that decides all of that. And again, that gives rise to this appellation of it as being fringe, being crazy, as being not just far from the normal realm of constitutional interpretation, but way beyond it. And indeed, the North Carolina legislature looks at this and says, no, that can't be the case. This theory that you're advancing, North Carolina, legislature would be, and these are the words from the Supreme Court in North Carolina, it says that would be repugnant to the sovereignty of states, right? The authority of state constitutions and the independence of state courts, talking about history in America, certainly in North Carolina as well, and would produce absurd and dangerous consequences, some of which I've just hinted at. So the Supreme Court rejects all of that. The legislature comes back and says, no, we're not going to accept that. Let's take this up to the United States Supreme Court, not only contesting whether or not our line drawing did accomplish this gerrymandering, this partisan gerrymandering that I've described, but also we want to say that, you know what, the courts have no business being here in here from the first place. And they revived this theory. It's been around for maybe 20, 30, 40 years, always footnotes, always dismissed by courts as being ridiculous. But scary, because our Supreme Court in this term, four members of the Supreme Court said, yeah, let's take a look at that. Let's see whether or not it does have some credibility to this particular theory. Let's take a look at this. And so from the time of the oral argument in December, when the Supreme Court seemed to be somewhat split, entertaining very seriously this notion that the courts have no involvement in deciding portions of our elections and instead vesting all of that responsibility in our state courts, that was seriously entertained by our United States Supreme Court. The consequences of a decision in the support of the North Carolina legislature, I would offer, would have been catastrophic to our republic, to the future of our nation, because, again, not only eliminating the checks and balances, the proper assignment of authorities among the branches, but also undermining the elections coming up in just the years just ahead, the months just ahead here in Wisconsin and throughout the United States of America. Thankfully, I've already given you the lead, which is that the Supreme Court 6-3 dismissed this notion. And also said that the independent state legislature theory does not have credibility. Rejecting this position, the Chief Justice wrote, the Elections Clause does not insulate state legislatures from the ordinary exercise of state judicial review. And as a result of that, this is put back to bed where it should have been for a long period of time. Interestingly, in the opinion, the Supreme Court also says something else about state courts. It says state courts do not have free rein and are still subject to oversight by federal courts involving federal elections. And went on to say the questions presented in this area are complex and context specific. When we come back, I'm going to tell you more about what John Roberts and the majority meant by that and why that language is also some continuing reason for concern here in 21st century America, 2023 and 2024. Stay with us for that discussion coming up right after this break.
This summer, 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW has a new starting lineup.
Starting at 6 AM, the Mayor and Mino.
Then at 8, the Earl Ingram Show.
On WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. President Biden called the decision to send cluster munitions to Ukraine a difficult one, but some NATO allies are opposed to the decision. That includes the defense minister of Spain. And ABC's Mary Alice Park says this decision comes just before next week's NATO summit.
Of course, we expect that NATO will look at other ways to support Ukraine, but also debate its own membership. Just this last year, NATO grew. Finland was formally introduced as a new alliance partner in April, meaning that NATO has a new border with Russia.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen continuing her meetings in Beijing, telling her Chinese counterpart that the U.S. would protect its interests. 4 days in the last week have broken records for the hottest global temperatures ever recorded. And police in Pennsylvania looking for a man who escaped from a Warren County jail. Michael Burham, considered very dangerous. He's being held on arson and burglary charges, also suspected in a homicide investigation. This is ABC News.
For Civic Media News, I'm Pete Schwabe. Here's what you need to know in Northeast Wisconsin.
An Appleton house fire causes $170,000 in damage. The Appleton Fire Department received a 911 call around 8:20 p.m. on Thursday. They arrived at the scene on the 200 block of South Fidelis to find very thick smoke coming from the back of the house. Crews had the fire under control in about 30 minutes. No one was injured, and the cause of the fire will be investigated.
There are new details about a man who was found dead in a ditch on the 4th of July. He's been identified as 74-year-old Jan Richmond of Sheboygan. Authorities say he was walking on the shoulder when he was struck from behind by a minivan driven by a 37-year-old man. The incident took place on the 2800 block of Enterprise Drive in Sheboygan around 8 a.m. Richmond was pronounced dead at the scene, according to the Sheboygan County Sheriff's Office. The driver of the minivan was apprehended. Tichwaba, Civic Media News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
Living happily ever after isn't always a reality. If you're over 50 and are considering divorce, attorney Andrea Gage with the Everson Law Firm can provide the guidance you need. Andrea focuses on silver divorces, the kind that get more complicated over time and present unique challenges. A family, multiple properties, significant assets. Andrea and the team at Everson Law have the experience to protect your interests. Call Everson Law to set up an appointment with Andrea today. It's never too late to be happy. Everson Law, 920-435-3734.
Hey, this is Petty Pincher Bob, and I love a good rummage sale. If you love them too, you can list your Saturday rummage sale right here on this radio station. Your 15-second Saturday rummage sale ad runs Friday all day and Saturday morning for only $50 per week. If you would like to list your Saturday rummage sale, call us now, 715-629-9501. The deadline for each week is Wednesday at noon. Operators are standing by now. Please have a valid credit card ready to go. See ya!
This summer, 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW has a new starting lineup.
Woo-hoo! Starting at 6 AM, the Mayor and Mino.
Then at 8, the Earl Ingram Show.
10 to 12,
As Goes Wisconsin. At noon, Civic Media Network News. At 12:15, Town Call. 1 to 3, the Todd Alba Show.
3 to 4, Matt Flint Direct.
4 to 6, the Devil's Advocates with Dom and Crude. And 6 to 7, the Maggie Dawn Show.
On 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW.
We are back talking this morning, as we have in our two prior broadcasts, about the United States Supreme Court, and focusing in the first portion of our discussion this morning on this case coming out of North Carolina called Moore versus Harper. Moore versus Harper, the case that could have upended our very way of doing elections in America by, again, if the Supreme Court had gone in the opposite direction, by placing not just primacy, but almost virtually unchecked authority in our state legislatures for making decisions not only about the times and places and manner of holding elections, but then deciding how those rules rules and regulations are to be implemented. Something that's always, throughout the 240 years of our history, been delegated and properly assigned to our state courts when it comes to the administration of elections and even challenges to elections, both state and federal. And we recall well that in the last presidential term, one of the candidates went into court 60 different times to determine whether or not he was the successful candidate for the presidency. And while you may agree or disagree with that tactic, the reality is it's an affirmation of the proper allocation of responsibility. Going into court is the way that you challenge what happens in elections in America. This concept, the independent state legislature theory, would have turned that back and, again, undermined not only our process, but have stolen from all of you the capacity to vote in a way that's meaningful and would have placed that responsibility, that is, who won and who lost, in the hands of state legislatures across the country, not just here in Wisconsin, but throughout the United States, could have accomplished some very, very, as the North Carolina Supreme Court, dangerous, absurd consequences in states where Democrats are in charge, in states where Republicans are in charge, across the board. This would have been an anti-democratic approach. The Supreme Court, again, 6-3, rejected the theory along the way, right before the break, commenting that the Chief Justice also said states' courts don't have free rein. Interesting commentary inside this otherwise very clear opinion from the majority of our Supreme Court. The questions presented, he says, are complex, context-specific. That state courts may not transgress the ordinary bounds of judicial review such that they arrogate to themselves the power vested in state legislatures to regulate federal elections. What does all that mean? Well, the language almost certainly indicating that while we're going to give the state courts, in this case, certainly the North Carolina Supreme Court, the free rein, as it should have, to decide whether or not there is gerrymandering going on in North Carolina. Still, the Supreme Court says there may be those circumstances where federal courts, like the Supreme Court, will intervene and make decisions to overrule, to supersede the decisions of state courts. We are mindful, of course, of the major decision, Bush versus Gore, and the change of the millennium, 2000, in which the federal Supreme Court overruled the Florida Supreme Court when it came to counting ballots in that state and basically handed the presidency to one candidate as opposed to another. We remember that because this language speaks to that capacity the Supreme Court is still reserving for itself in those cases in the future where it may determine that state courts have gone beyond what they should do. Federal courts can still become involved. Again, another reason to be concerned about this language in Moore versus Harper, even though overall this is a very positive decision, a reason not to celebrate, as I will get to in just a moment or so, but to reaffirm the way in which we do elections in America. The footnote to this important story is just this. What happened after this is going forward is, of course, in North Carolina, there was a map that was redrawn. It was redrawn by experts appointed by a state court. And that, believe it or not, resulted in a 14-member congressional delegation that was, in the end, evenly split between Republicans and Democrats, roughly once again mirroring the state's partisan divisions, exactly what I described before. So it affirms this notion that when you have a group of people who are not political and they're drawing lines based upon demographics and population, the census results, you get non-gerrymandered, for the most part, non-gerrymandered elections, and that's what we should all strive to. We also know that in the interim, the composition of the North Carolina Supreme Court changed after some elections that happened in November of last year. And the composition of that court, not the Supreme Court in Washington, D.C., but the North Carolina Supreme Court, changed in favor of the so-called conservatives and in what a dissenting justice called a shameful manipulation of fundamental principles of our democracy and the rule of law. That new majority, the new members of the Supreme Court in the new majority, reversed course and said the legislature was, in fact, free to draw those gerrymandering voting districts as it saw fit. And that, again, not just complicates, but adds another layer of interest to this overall matter. Plainly, issues related to independence of the
judiciary, the role of the courts in doing this kind of thing and reviewing what legislatures do and reviewing what the executive branch does, a major theme of our next discussion, all that affirmed by this case, Moore versus Harper, and a reason, as I said before, not necessarily to celebrate because, again, let me say it at the start here, I will repeat this a number of times, I suspect, we escaped a very bad thing happening here. A very bad thing would have happened in America had the majority, had, frankly, two more justices decided in favor of the North Carolina legislature and adopted this independent state legislature theory. The elections coming up here in Wisconsin four times in the year 2024 would have been dramatically, markedly different in determining challenges to the election results, not by courts, but by legislatures, had this case gone in the opposite direction. So we acknowledge the importance of it. We don't celebrate it because it simply reestablishes, reaffirms, upholds what has always been our tradition. Nothing new, nothing different, nothing innovative, nothing creative to advance the purpose of government happened here. A simple reestablishment, a reaffirmation that the way that we do it is in fact fair and just and decent and consistent with the rule of law. And so once again, Moore versus Harper decided in the same week, a couple of days before some of these other cases we talked about just last week were also decided. We're going to chat more about those cases in just a few moments. We've got at least one caller on the line right now calling in this morning from Merrimack. Jack, appreciate your comment, your question here on our broadcast.
Well, I think we absolutely have to do something about this U.S. Supreme Court. Much like our arrogant Wisconsin legislators who, due to gerrymandering, have seen no voter consequences, no matter how extreme their actions, these justices with lifetime appointments also believe they'll see no consequences. They're corrupt. They rule on cases brought by people who have given them and their spouses or their spouses millions. They've changed legislation, for example, by saying that the EPA doesn't have the regulatory authority that Congress gave it. They've reversed what they have said in their nomination hearings was established law. Unless we do something about this, this court will reverse progress that's taken 50, 100 years or longer to make. And they'll keep on doing it for decades after the octogenarians who appointed them are dead. I can think of a couple of possible solutions to this. From my personal perspective, the best thing to do would be to expand the court. When this court originally got 9 members, was expanded to 9, there were 9 federal districts. And that meant that each justice could sort of keep an eye on one of those districts.
In the late 19th century, right? That's when we last expanded it to 9. Exactly right, Jack. Yes.
And we've got 13 federal districts now. We should have 4 more justices.
Right.
If that can't be done, possibly we could get through Congress a law that has a sort of a term limit for these guys. You can't fire them, but you could say, well, we can make these guys after 10, 15, 20 years, pick the number, a justice emeritus. They have no voting capability, but they can still stay in the court as advisors.
Right, right.
And then after that period of time, justices could be nominated and appointed to replace those emeritus justices as voting members.
Right.
Of
some very
ideally, it'd be nice to eliminate the lifetime appointments and just flat out set a term limit. But getting a constitutional amendment, we can't even get a constitutional amendment for equal rights for half the population.
Right. Lots and lots of great things, Jack. I so appreciate the call this morning. And I appreciate it especially because some of the things you spoke about initially, that is the consequences of these decisions. I'm going to chat about that principally in our second hour. The way in which these cases have really redefined who we are as a nation. We're going to get back to that point. We chatted already a little bit about the ethics issue and the issue of doing something, right? What do you do about that? Which is always the third question we ask. I appreciate so much your articulating that as well.
You know, there are things that, can be done out there. And the second one that you identified, this idea of term limits, where does that come from? Well, it comes from the language, again, in the Article 3 that says that justices, and frankly, all federal judges, they get lifetime tenure while they're serving under good behavior. Good behavior is a term that's in the Constitution that has always been interpreted to mean lifetime tenure. In other words, you can't get rid of them for any reason. You can impeach. You can impeach federal judges. We've had one Supreme Court justice who has been impeached, but that's been interpreted that way. So you could go back, and there are those scholars out there, Jack, much to your point, who say, you know what, that language could be meant to convey the notion, yes, we'll keep them during their good behavior of a certain term. And that may be 10 years or 12 years or 15 years or 20 years. And perhaps the Congress might be able to redefine what a term is. Short of that, as you indicated, a constitutional amendment has to happen to change sort of that good behavior language. That's a heavy lift, Jack, as you just identified. The issue about numbers of justices is perhaps more accessible, although even in this Congress, probably a difficult thing to do. As we indicated in our back and forth here, Jack, just a moment or so ago, the late 19th century, 1800s or so, late 1890s or so, is when we finally settled on nine, going back and forth for a number of different political reasons over our history, ultimately settling on nine. It stayed there ever since then. The United States Congress, as a part of its oversight and involvement with the Supreme Court, can in fact change that number. You could increase it, as we know well. There have been proposals, not just under FDR, but other presidents, to increase, to decrease the number, and that can be done by legislation. Now, again, it has to be passed by both houses of Congress, signed by the president, and that right now is probably a heavy lift. But that kind of thing is also an option out there that can be done legislatively. The other probably done almost exclusively constitutionally. The third thing I would offer, Jack, in addition to your two suggestions, is simple advocacy, right? Conversations not only like this one, but plainly the American population, not only in the wake of what happened last week, not just this previous week, but 2 weeks ago, and throughout the recent terms, is responding in a way that suggests disapproval of much of the population, not everyone, but much of the population, of the kinds of major changes in who we are in America happening these days. We think specifically to the major change of last June 2022, the decision in Dobbs, in which the Supreme Court, for the first time, rolled back the notion of privacy rights, begun to be established way back in 1965, at a time when the Supreme Court was wrestling with contraception, found, yes, indeed, there's this penumbra of rights that emanates from the Supreme Court, its determination that out of the Constitution these rights emanate, and establishes privacy rights we all have, all kinds of things, including the right to make decisions about reproductive services. And that, again, in place since 1973, that particular privacy right, until 2022, the decision authored by Justice Sam Alito, basically saying for the first time in our history, turning back that movement forward of privacy rights and finding that that right no longer exists with respect to abortion and reproductive rights, that kind of thing, prompting people to say, gosh, this Supreme Court out of touch, not consistent with polls, and certainly don't want them to be responding every time a poll changes. But in these major issues, a great concern. And so, Jack, appreciate very much your observations about that. And indeed, in our next segments here, we're going to talk more about the first things that you, Jack, identified, which is, what does this really mean for America? We're also going to talk about something else you mentioned, Jack, which is the concept of standing. You mentioned very briefly that some of these cases, they're improperly. We're going to talk about that more in connection with two of the cases, the LGBT case and the loan forgiveness case, when we come back here in Morning Cannolis. Stay with us for that discussion and much more.
Yeah.
Living happily ever after isn't always a reality. If you're over 50 and are considering divorce, attorney Andrea Gage with the Everson Law Firm can provide the guidance you need. Andrea focuses on silver divorces, the kind that get more complicated over time and present unique challenges. A family, multiple properties, significant assets. Andrea and the team at Everson Law have the experience to protect your interests. Call Everson Law to set up an appointment with Andrea today. It's never too late to be happy. Everson Law, 920-435-3734.
Hey, this is Penny Pincher Bob, and I love a good rummage sale. If you love them too, you can list your Saturday rummage sale right here on this radio station. Your 15-second Saturday rummage sale ad runs Friday all day and Saturday morning for only $50 per week. If you would like to list your Saturday rummage sale, call us now, 715-629-9501. The deadline for each week is Wednesday at noon. Operators are standing by now. Please have a valid credit card ready to go. See ya!
This summer, 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW has a new starting lineup.
Woo-hoo! Starting at 6 AM, the Mayor and Mino.
Then at 8, the Earl Ingram Show.
10 to 12,
As Goes Wisconsin. At noon, Civic Media Network News. At 12:15, Town Call. 1 to 3, the Todd Alba Show. 3 to 4, Matt Flynn Direct. 4 to 6, the Devil's Advocates with Dom and Crew. And 6 to 7, the Maggie Dawn Show.
On 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW.
Here's your updated forecast. Chance for scattered storms this afternoon. Otherwise, partly cloudy skies. Daytime highs approaching 78. North winds 5 to 10 miles an hour. Partly cloudy skies again. Tonight, lows level off around 57. Mainly clear tomorrow. Daytime highs approaching 82. Upper 80s Monday with a chance for scattered storms. Turning much cooler Tuesday with highs in the upper 70s and scattered showers possible. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Ray Miller. Right now, it's 64.
This summer, 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW has a new starting lineup. 1 to 3, The Todd Alba Show.
3 to 4, Matt Flynn Direct
on WGBW.
We're back once again talking this morning. Thank you for joining me here on Morning Cannolis, talking about the United States Supreme Court. And I promised in our first segments this morning to talk about these two large buckets, if you will, of cases decided in the last several weeks. And again, let's go back and chat a little bit about what those are. We have spent much of our time in previous broadcasts discussing the specifics of these cases, but note once again that in the decisions rendered a couple of weeks ago, including this case, Moore versus Harper, dismissing the independent state legislature theory, what did the Supreme Court do? The Supreme Court maintained the status quo to the good to ensure that our republic remains strong. They did this in a number of different ways. They said, for example, that the legislative established right of the Secretary of Homeland Security to use some limited resources in his agency to investigate and deport illegal immigrants, people who are illegally here, who pose the greatest threat to our national security and local safety, that that's a discretionary judgment call made by the Secretary of Homeland Security. That's a proper exercise of executive authority. That's reestablishing, that's simply reaffirming the long-standing tradition. That's reaffirming what is good and right and decent when it comes to the separation of powers among our branches of government. And the Supreme Court said that out loud. The Supreme Court also confirmed, again, the long-settled meaning and the power of the Voting Rights Act, Section 2, in prohibiting racially based gerrymandering. Again, this is racial gerrymandering when it comes to some congressional representation to people of color. A major voting rights case that, again, did not change the world, reaffirmed the world that we understand here in the United States of America. Section 2, the meaning and power of the Voting Rights Act, a surprise for many people given the recent history of the Supreme Court, a case called Shelby County, another one called Brnovich, that was turning back the voting rights cases. But this case in particular, the Supreme Court recently says, nope, the Voting Rights Act still has power to deny racial gerrymandering in the United States of America, reaffirming, establishing once again, the status quo stays in place. A third case we also talked about, upholding the constitutionality of the Indian Child Welfare Act, sometimes called the ICWA. What does that do? It safeguards the heritage of the youngest members of our indigenous populations, our youngest citizens here in the United States and all sorts of things like adoption, placement, custody proceedings in our state courts, a thing that has been out there once again, a piece of legislation that advances not only the heritage and the legitimacy of continuing that heritage for our Native American populations, but it would offer for all of us who are concerned about our history and the future generations of our nation. Affirming that long-standing traditional understanding about how ICWA works in America. And finally, this case in validating the right of nursing home patients to sue for mistreatment when they have been mistreated by nursing home healthcare providers. Again, under what? Under traditional civil rights principles and the very foundations of Medicaid and arguably Medicare as well. Reaffirming once again, maintaining the status quo in all of those cases. Again, not necessarily a reason to celebrate. Nothing new, nothing different happened, but a reason to be pleased that the bad things that would have happened going in the opposite direction did not happen. Just like the ISLT, the Independent State Legislature theory, a bad thing didn't happen there, and we escaped once again a bad consequence. Just like in all of these cases, Supreme Court reaffirming the good things about the way the rule of law is administered. Contrast that with what the Supreme Court did a couple of weeks ago in four other cases. I'll reach back even further than 4 weeks ago. The Clean Water Act case, the Sackett case we talked about a number of weeks ago, finding that the EPA, as Jack indicated in his discussion with us not too long ago, just a few minutes ago, does not have the authority that we always understood it did to address dumpings and pollution of wetlands, specifically finding that if you're dumping materials into wetlands that are simply adjacent to but not adjoining major navigable waters, the coverage of the Clean Water Act does not apply, significantly hamstringing the capacity, as Jack indicated, of the EPA to enforce the law. Recall as well that a couple of terms ago, Supreme Court did the same thing, actually just last term, with respect to the Environmental Protection Agency and the Clean Air Act case, finding that the executive branch did not have the authority to place limits on greenhouse gas emissions of major corporations and companies that are belching out these pollutants into our air, limiting, turning back the way that our history has been. A split decision again, ruling, overturning about 40 years of judicial precedent and prohibiting public and private universities nationwide from considering what? Considering race in their reviews of the candidacies of potential student enrollees. One candidacy issue among many others, prohibiting that from being considered, turning back decisions of the Supreme Court, going in the opposite direction, not maintaining the status quo, but going back to a time before we had the good things that come of an academic setting where people are different, both demographically and in terms of their views about the world. They turn that back. Similarly, a no less controversial ruling in favor of a wedding website provider, we talked about this just last week, who alleged a violation of her free speech rights in the potential application to her of a Colorado law prohibiting commercial discrimination against same-sex couples, including other immutable characteristics. That, likewise, sending us backwards, not establishing, maintaining the Supreme Court's long-standing tradition of encouraging civil rights and human rights, the movement forward that was accomplished by previous Supreme Courts in establishing not just same-sex marriage under these cases that were issued by Anthony Kennedy, but also most recently written by Neil Gorsuch, establishing that under Title VII, that our LGBT communities do in fact receive protection against discrimination in employment under the Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. All of those cases, from Clean Water Act to the Title VII, reversing what has been the tradition in this nation, going back in a direction that we have not previously seen. And again, for that reason, significant in understanding the very mixed and very different kinds of things that the Supreme Court has done during this period of time. We have some other callers on the line in this last portion of our time together. Let's begin to talk, Joe. I may have to cut you off at this top of the hour, but Joe, let's begin our conversation with you. Stay with me if indeed we don't get a chance to talk about everything you have to say this morning. Glad to have you with us again, Joe. Your thought or comment?
Just 2 points, and I'd love to hear you expand on them. I'll just bring them up, and you can do as you wish. In speaking of the outcome of this independent state legislature case that came up. You used this wonderful language where you said it is both ridiculous and scary, but yet it was pretty close. It wasn't that clear cut that it was. They didn't all come out and say this is a really dumb idea. So my first question is, does the ruling by the Supreme Court, this is going to sound really naive, does this kill it for now, or can somebody bring a case similar to this again in the future and this independent state legislature idea be tossed around again? My second question
And Joanne, is, what I'm going to do is, just because of our break right now, that is an excellent question. I'm going to have you stay in the line with me if you've got the time to do so, because I want to hear your second question. But I'm going to take the first answer right after our top of the hour break. Please stay with me, Joe, and please stay with me, everyone, because Joe's asking some great questions about the AASLT, which we'll talk about at the top of our next hour. Joe, stay with me. Everybody else, stay with me as well, yes, here on Morning Cannolis.
I know you don't do it usually, but dear Lord, she's dying.
This summer, 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW has a new starting lineup. Starting at 6 a.m., The Mayor and Mino. Then at 8, The Earl Ingram Show. 10 to 12, As Goes Wisconsin. At noon, Civic Media Network News. At 12:15, Town Call. 1 to 3, The Todd Alba Show. 3 to 4, Matt Flynn Direct. 4 to 6, The Devil's Advocates with Dom and Crude. And 6 to 7, The Maggie Dawn Show.
On 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW.
Pursuing the truth wherever it may lead. The Todd Alba Show. Weekday afternoons from 1 till 3. Join the conversation. Get involved. The Todd Alba Show on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming
ABC
on the Civic
News,
Media
I'm
app.
Brian Clark.